going to get weirder and weirder and weirder.
Welcome to the show that the fact checkers warned you about. The one that debunks the mainstream narrative and gives you high signal, actionable content that helps you navigate the clown world. It's Bomb Thrower TV with your host, Mark Jeftovic.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Bomb Thrower TV. I've got my first ever repeat guest here on BTTV. That's Joe Allen, who was on last summer. Or when did Dark Aeon come out? When did you drop the
book? That was, not last summer. It was summer of 2023. Feels like yesterday and an eternity all at once.
Yeah. So you're our first repeat guest on the show, which is... your dubious honor. And we're here today because we both met up again on Steve Bannon's War Room a couple days ago. Was that just yesterday? No, it was Monday. Today is Wednesday. Okay. And I know time's just accelerating, right? We were talking about the singularity. And of course, I wrote an article, and we can talk about that, called "The Singularity Has Already Happened. We're Living in a Post-Singularity World." Kind of blew Bannon's mind, just the concept. And very quickly, you messaged me privately, "Bro, no, you're completely wrong on this." I think some people are expecting this to be a debate. We've talked offline. This isn't a debate. This is more of a conversation. I think we'll start there, though, because obviously... what the normal and the variations are, there's a lot of variations, but the normal definition of a singularity, I guess, by any rational definition, we're not there. We're not living in a post-singularity world. It's, as you say, it's where everything sort of goes completely vertical. I suppose when I think back on it, what I'm trying to articulate, what I was trying to explain would be more... apt to be called an event horizon. But even that, like, you know, in a black hole, there's the event horizon. Once you cross the event horizon, there's no going back, and the singularity is at the middle of that black hole, the center of it, and you're falling towards that gravitational singularity. But even that, I find, is kind of a bad, or it doesn't capture what I was trying to get across, because to your point, you said, Mark, you know, the invention of the wheel was crossing the event horizon. You know, electricity, telephones, telegraph, all of that was an event horizon. Every technological advancement was driving us forward. What I'm trying to capture is this whole idea of accelerating acceleration. And before we got on, I asked GPT what accelerating acceleration is, and I don't know if it's hallucinating because I haven't had time to fact check this, but it's like, okay, yeah, the velocity.
I'm not doing it. Nope. No,
you're not listening.
No.
Well, I didn't like the word it came back with, anyways, which is jerk, which is the
what?
Jerk. It says it is
called you a jerk.
No, it said jerk is the third derivative of position and acceleration is the second derivative of position. And it said there are fourth, fifth, and sixth derivatives of position. Guess what they're called?
Give it to me.
Snap, crackle, and pop.
No. Yeah, I'm no physicist.
Listen, that's what GPT says, so that's reality.
It must be.
Therein lies our point. So...
I did take physics. I did it at the graduate level. I took a course in quantum physics, actually, learned calculus in order to do it. And I think maybe one of the reasons I am so troubled by physicists and technicians is because I'm not very good at any of that. So in a world ruled by mathematicians and physicists and technicians, I would be at the bottom of the heap. So maybe it's selfish, but Given my ineptitude in those fields, or at least I'm very average, I hate them.
Okay, so
Hate.
GPT is hallucinating and Joe hates physicists, and we don't know what to call what I'm trying to articulate of crossing a point of no return, of accelerating acceleration.
Should we start with Ray Kurzweil?
Sure.
You know, one thing that really bothers me about how Kurzweil is elevated is that there's this assumption that because he predicted it, it's more than likely accurate among a lot of different both people in tech, but mainly kind of the mouthpieces, so that you hear people like Elon Musk, you hear people like Greg Brockman of OpenAI deferring to Ray Kurzweil's model of the projected future. And again, it's not that they're completely uncritical about it, but they're not critical enough, I don't think. People oftentimes say Ray Kurzweil was 86% correct in his projections of the future. I've never seen this broken down, but I do know from reading his work that you are constantly finding all of these different predictions that he absolutely did not get correct. The Age of Spiritual Machines, published in 1999, tons of stuff that is not correct. Tons of those predictions did not come true. Just one, for instance, he thought that by now virtual reality would be ubiquitous and adopted across the planet. And I thought maybe, you know, when the metaverse was being pushed through Mark Zuckerberg's newly rebranded company Meta, I thought that especially in the kind of pandemic restriction lockdown sort of mode we were in, that you would see mass adoption, and that certainly didn't happen. I was completely wrong, and mainly because I think I was following that hype wave way too closely, and I was also holed up in Montana, which will make you weird anyway. But one way or the other, Ray Kurzweil's model of the singularity is based on previous models, but it is at least it gives you a really good idea of how many transhumanists or posthumanists or accelerationists do foresee the future. Very, you know, in its current form, you've got right now 2025. He says right on track to be where he believes we will be. By 2029, he says 2030, or 2030, 2029, you get artificial general intelligence. So right now we have all of these artificial narrow intelligence systems that can do specific tasks. They are becoming more and more general. Multimodal models are a kind of step in the direction of general intelligence, but it's still very, very narrow. So ChatGPT processes language. The newest iteration of GPT is, again, more general, or one of the newer iterations, 04, or is it 4.0?
The
It,
model numbers baffle me because it seems like the new iterations go down in model number, and it's like.
No, well, no, not this, not, not this one. But it is confusing because you have GPT 4.5, which powers ChatGPT, but you also have 4.0, or is it 0.4? You also have 0.3, or is it 3.0?
And
I think it's
01,
4.0
and like,
and 0.3. So yeah, it is kind of confusing. All this is to say that these narrow systems are still restricted to certain domains for the most part. And what he anticipates, and many others, is that by 2029, 2030, you're going to get artificial general intelligence. That just simply means a system that is much more flexible and can operate across multiple domains, perhaps all domains of human intelligence, including at least what will appear to be emotion, and all of these different reasoning faculties that really artificial intelligence, as it's called now, doesn't have. So you get artificial general intelligence. Some define general intelligence as being as good as any human being on the planet at anything a human being can think about or do or reason through. That would also, though, mean it's de facto super intelligent or superhuman, because no human being can think that fast. No human being can rake through that much data. No human being will have that breadth of capability. So it's de facto superhuman artificial general intelligence 2029. Then, because of the creation and adoption of this technology, coupled with human beings forming a direct interface with artificial intelligence through either non-invasive forms or, as Kurzweil envisions it, invasive forms. You've got Elon Musk with Neuralink, which is pretty brutal. You're drilling a hole in the skull and putting electrodes into the brain. Kurzweil has an even more bizarre notion of how this will happen. He has long said it will be nanotechnology that does it, and so you'll have nanobots, small processors, billions of them, injected into the bloodstream. Somehow you've got to get through the blood-brain barrier into the brain. He again waves a magic wand, says we will, and then you'll flood the brain with all of these sensors so that you have then a direct connection between basically the whole brain and any AI system that exists in the cloud. You basically have an antenna for a head, and you are channeling this. And as this becomes more and more widely adopted, 8.5 billion people on the planet, give or take now, that collective intelligence, coupled with the training of artificial intelligence, will begin to, you'll start that upward curve towards that event horizon, moving into a near vertical, exponential advancement in intelligence, an intelligence explosion, that being the singularity, just that point at which Kurzweil envisions by 2045, we will be millions or billions of times smart. AI, or the collective of all of this AI, will be millions or billions of times smarter than human beings are now. And by the end of the century, trillions of trillions of times smarter, right? So basically, we kind of become small g gods because we've linked ourselves to the machine, but the swarms of intelligence become either a pantheon of gods, or if they form a singleton, if they actually start operating in harmony or are subsumed under one ultimate intelligence, big G God. Kurzweil is famously said long ago, he was asked, "Do you believe in God? Do you believe God exists?" And he said, "No, not yet." And that's the future as he sees it. The singularity will be massive intelligence explosions by way of digital technology and brain computer interfaces, creating God in essence. And then we will swarm out across the solar system, the galaxy, into other galaxies, converting everything in our path, this bizarre new human machine hybrid, or just machines at this point, because the human has been dissolved and discarded, and converting everything in the solar system and the galaxy into computronium. Basically, the entire universe will become a big computer. This is his dream. I do not subscribe to this dream. I should be very clear, but that's what he's talking about with the singularity.
Have you ever read Werner Wing's Fire in the Deep?
I have not, but maybe it's a good segue into the original forms of the singularity as it was envisioned by Benji. But no, I haven't. Does he deal with that in that book? People have recommended it.
I'll just insert a quick comparison, and then you can pick that thread up. In the book, archaeologists, future archaeologists, a couple million years out, they're excavating a computer bank they find on a foreign planet. That's archaeology in those days. And they unleash a super intelligent light that starts rippling across the galaxy and the universe itself, consuming entire galaxies, right? And so the rest of the galaxies, and you get these distant empires that no one had ever heard of from other galaxies saying we must unite against the plague or the bots or whatever they are. And that sounds like Kurzweil wants us to be the blight that goes out and consumes the entire galaxy. I have more I can say on that, but go on with your thread on the singularities.
Converting everything in the solar system and the galaxy and the universe into computronium definitely has that fungal infection sort of
It's
feel
the
to it, doesn't
Borg.
it?
It's like you will be assimilated, right?
And Kurzweil insists that because humans created AI and because we've merged with it and we've uploaded our personalities into it and all of this, that it will, in essence, still be human. So he doesn't see himself as a post-humanist or a full, like the long distance transhumanist. These definitions, even the singularity itself, is, they're very, very slippery. You can end up in all sorts of little side quests trying to figure out what they really mean. But yeah, he believes that this is ultimately like the cosmos becoming man.
And people think that we're like people like Kurzweil, and who that's escaping me the Fermi's paradox. They believe we are the only sentient life in the universe right now, anyway. So we're doing the universe a favor by animating this dead, floating, useless matter into humanity.
Yeah, it's a I think even that assumption alone, I mean, I'm not a big UFO guy, but the assumption that the entire cosmos, you've got trillions of galaxies full of trillions of stars, or at least billions of stars, some of them trillions, and many, many planets around them. It seems very, 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 it seems like a lot of wasted real estate, if you're,
Yeah.
But I think, not only there's something inherent in Kurzweil and a number of the transhumanists that I've read and studied their work. The atheism is so dramatic that it includes extraterrestrials, right? Not only do they look out to the cosmos and see no God present and no spirit within human beings, but they also, for whatever reason, have a kind of a many of them anyway, a block in regards to the possibility of other life out there. It's just like there's this inherent deadness to their view of the cosmos.
It's not just out there, Joe. It's in here too, because most ra they're all radical material reductionists. So they all believe that our minds and our brains our minds are just something our brains gas off, right? That it's all just neurochemical billiards in our heads that give rise to thought and consciousness, and at their root core of their belief system, like Dennett, is it Dennett?
Daniel Dennett, yeah.
Like consciousness is an illusion. And this,
Yeah.
to me, is one of the inherent contradictions of transhumanism, is that you're not even conscious, you just think you are. It's an illusion. Everything is just a billiard ball universe. And if we could calculate the trajectory of every sub-quantum atom, particle in the universe, we would know exactly what you're going to do before you even do it. So your consciousness is an illusion. It's all just reflex on one level or another. But we're going to take that consciousness and we're going to upload it into the cloud, and you'll live forever, even though you're not really conscious and you're technically not even really alive, because it's all an illusion.
Yeah, there is variety. That is, I would say, the dominant paradigm within transhumanism, or whatever label you want to put on it now. Transhumanism is pr a pretty passé term. I oftentimes joke that I wrote the last book about transhumanism because it's so out of date, and it real to be honest, it already was then, but it does, I think, at least capture the broad whole of, the descendants of transhumanism, the effective altruists, the effective accelerationists, the optimalists and biohackers, all of these different branches that are really at the forefront of this thought now, they still bear the marks of the previous transhumanist movement with Max Moore and Nick Bostrom, Ben Goetzel, and who are still active. By the way, just as an example, Ben Goetzel flirts with the woo quite a bit. I think he is ultimately a materialist. He's kind of hard to pin down, but he definitely flirts with the woo, as the woo-woo, the magic, the non-physical realms. As does Nick Land, and I don't know that you could really. I've not read him enough to pin him down completely. He seems very comfortable with this notion of a singularity, a techno-capital acceleration leading to a singularity, but like many people, he changes his mind. At any rate, just for the audience's edification, if you can take a little bit more singularity talk, you know, Ray Kurzweil put the stamp on the singularity really with his book, The Singularity Is Near, 2005. He'd been speaking in those terms for some time, but if I recall correctly, even in the Age of Spiritual Machines, 1999, if he does mention the singularity, it's certainly not a central focus. At that point, he's talking about something like that, but that's not the metaphor he uses, that metaphor of the black hole. That does come from Werner Vinge. You know, according to one person who knew John von Neumann, the physicist and computer science pioneer, World War II and after, John von Neumann reportedly said that humanity is heading towards a singularity. And so, it's sometime in the 50s, around the same time the artificial intelligence is coined, he is attributed the term, the first use of the term is attributed to him. And after him, you have others who hint at it. So I.J. Goode, writing in the 60s, if I'm not mistaken, talked about ultra-intelligent machines. And he also described a kind of singularity. Like once you have an ultra-intelligent machine, that it would basically be humanity's last invention, because then the machine will basically do all the inventing for us, and we're just along for the ride, which has the same feel. But the singularity really became part of the kind of techno optimist and techno utopian transhumanist lexicon with a paper that was delivered by Werner Vinge, the sci-fi writer you just mentioned, to NASA scientists and various space aerospace scientists, called "The Coming Technological Singularity" in 1993, and in that, Werner Vinge presents the metaphor of the black hole, right? The mathematical concept of approaching zero, but never quite reaching it, and just, you know, the exponential increase up and up and up. And he took that metaphor, though, of the black hole. Once you get to the event horizon, not even light can escape, so you can't see into it. You have no idea what's going to happen. He applied it to technology, looking at the transhuman sort of direction in which he believed it would go. And he outlined in his original concept of the singularity four possible paths. Of those four, it could be a combination of them, but the first is that you have an artificial intelligence system that is superhuman in intelligence, and so it becomes the driver of the singularity. And so we can't imagine what would happen as normal human beings, because we just simply aren't intelligent enough to do so, is the idea. The second is that, and I may have his order a little mixed up, but whatever. The second is that human beings would enhance themselves biologically, either through brain manipulation, gene manipulation, or both, so that the future crop of humans, or humans that are being enhanced now, would be so super intelligent, so far beyond what we are now, that to us, we won't really be able to comprehend what's happening. We certainly won't be able to control what these super intelligent humanoids are doing. And so, again, you reach a kind of bio singularity there. The other is that human beings will merge with technology, so that is the path to superhuman intelligence. You could think brain computer interfaces, but it's still basically in the sphere of human beings rather than the first, with AI being the dominant driver. And the last is the idea that the internet and all the connections that the internet has, the nodes, are kind of a global brain, and each computer terminal, say, or server, is in a sense kind of like a neuron, with all the connections being kind of like axons and dendrites, and that itself will become the super intelligence, that the whole of the internet will be the driver, or just the whole of technological, all the embedded sensors and processors and whatnot will become collectively the driver of a singularity, you know, this moment in which superhuman intelligence alters history and everything before is transformed or obliterated. He added a fifth after that, which is kind of similar to the fourth, the Gaia hypothesis. And in this idea, you know, you have all of these sensors everywhere, all over the planet, and it's again, kind of an extension of the global brain, but it extends into the Internet of Things, the Internet of Bodies, and all of that. But he also thought that they could overlap. So what you have with Ray Kurzweil is it's definitely a synthesis of basically all of those different possible paths that Werner Vinge laid out, and you know, with different emphasis. But what I like about Werner Vinge's idea, the two things I like about it the most: one, he does really, you know, he simplifies it. It's easier to grasp than a 400 page, 350 page Ray Kurzweil tome, or the big one, the Big Daddy, The Singularity Is Near. You know, which is, it's a lot to take on. And Werner Vinge is much clearer because his writing is so simple, really. He's a fiction writer, so he knows how to grab an audience. But what I also like is that, you know, unlike Ray Kurzweil, who acknowledges the dangers for sure, but seems to believe that ultimately the optimistic view will prevail and everything's just going to be okay. We'll merge the machines, we'll invent God, and we'll all be happier for it. Whereas Vinge looks at it much more from an evolutionary standpoint, a strict Darwinian standpoint, and was, you know, he just passed away, a year ago or something, but was much more attuned to the dangers, especially from a Darwinian standpoint. For over the long haul, it could very easily end up being humans obliterated, leaving nothing but machines or mutants or any sort of, like, you know, like horrific and ugly future that leaves us out or enslaves us or turns us into pets. And I have to admit a certain bias on my own part, but that appeals to me much more because as you watch all of this unfold now, from my taste, it is already horrific. So if any of these technological developments even approximate or approach what Kurzweil's talking about, what Werner Vinge's talking about, what I.J. Goode was talking about, then it will, in essence, be an inescapable hell on earth for people like me. And I think probably people like you, Mark.
Where to begin?
Yeah, so I've been stewing on that for a couple of days. Hopefully that wasn't over long.
No, that's totally fine.
I've just had a mechanical failure in my seat. It's dumped me.
Oh, okay. The nanobots are upset. So there you are. I mean, one of the things, and I guess one of the reasons why I phrased it in such a sort of sucker punch kind of way, we're already post-singularity, is that I have this suspicion that, you know, these scenarios can be playing out right under our noses, and they already are, maybe in the early iterations, and we just don't recognize it. And that goes back to one of my fundamental axioms of we live in an out of control world. Now, back up a couple hundred years, we lived in an out of control world, but sort of most of the change was done by people adding torque to their personal gravitas or strength using machines. So they could, like, you know, change history by leveraging machines or leveraging early technologies. And that started accelerating and getting more leverage, more torque to less people. And now we're in this age where single individuals are carrying more gravitas and weight than nation states, to the chagrin of many. And I'm thinking, okay, that moment has already come and gone, right? Like, yeah, that's already old news. Now the technology itself, and that's why I said, once the code started coding, and there's probably, we may not agree on where we are in that story, but I did come up as a sysadmin and a coder. So I have been using this stuff to create code. And,
oh, Mark, no, stop.
It's true. Sorry to say, it's already impacting history, right? And so, and it's doing that not necessarily by infusing things with hyperintelligence and so we go completely vertical, but it's amplifying feedback loops so that it takes it out of the hands of people. I'm going to give a really super mundane example, right? The launch of Trump Coin. Going from zero to 68 billion in 48 hours was more than a feedback loop of opportunism and greed, right? It was like the feedback loops of the network and the amplification of automated bots. I don't mean this, like, I really have to put, I don't mean this like Russian bots are ruling the world and pumping Trump, because he's, I don't mean it from that perspective. I mean it from the, we've created this infrastructure and this architecture that has its own momentum, its own dynamics, its own speed, and it's faster than our human brains already. That's what I mean by it. And so that phenomena that took place in 48 hours and broke all the records, broke all the models. That was one of the things I wrote down, right? We're at the point after which all your models are broken. And I think that's the territory we're in. We're in this place, without getting political, right? My country, Canada, could conceivably cease to exist within days, weeks, months, whatever, because of a narrative has been introduced that is being amplified by networks and technology. So that's what I've been trying to articulate, without bringing it back to a debate of whether we're there or not. But just some of the things you were talking about is like, yeah, that's kind of what we're in, and people aren't really recognizing it. I know,
yeah,
there's a long way to go.
I agree, absolutely, especially. You know, Vinji himself, one of the metaphors he used about post-singularity reality versus ours is that our conception of the world would not be sufficient to understand it. So it would be like a chimpanzee or even a goldfish trying to figure out what all these humans are doing right now. And that gap that of understanding between something as simple as, say, a goldfish and the entirety of human cultural production is what we would see post-singularity. So that no matter how hard we tried, no matter how plainly it was explained to us, we would simply be baffled by everything going on around us. And that sense of confusion, that sense that the old models of the world have either worn out, their use has been has hit their its expiration date. I think we are there in many ways. It is, when you're at the center of innovation, and especially the center of adoption, it's going to, life looks very different, say, at the Googleplex than it does at your local Walmart, or whatever the equivalent is in Canada.
We got them.
Everything about it. I mean, yes, there are just, you know, distinctively human things happening that everybody can relate to, but ultimately, like, what's happening at Google, it would be baffling. Maybe not the gap of a chimpanzee to a human, but certainly the gap between, say, a British colonist and a Native American, and that gap is growing.
We already see that today. Like, we
that's what I'm saying. Yeah, yeah. I agree with you that we already have, like, that gap exists and is growing, maybe not to singularity levels of a dramatic rent in reality, but pretty close, I suppose, or at least it's comparable.
Yeah, I mean, there are more, and I think there are more and more people today that feel like the goldfish, right, in the Googleplex. You know, my wife was talking to someone yesterday. I won't say who it was. She's trying to help her, an elderly person. We're trying to help her out with some online banking thing. Really routine for you and me. Call ends. She didn't realize she didn't ring off the call, and my wife could hear her, like, sobbing, like, why can't I do this? Right. It's like, okay. Mm. Called her, come over, sit down. You know, it's like, this is a person who lives in the city, right? We're not talking about a person who lives in, like, some mining camp in, or whatever, like an igloo in Nunavut. It's like a person living in the city of Toronto is so overwhelmed by what we find routine. And that sort of blast radius of just, and I think about my parents, like my dad was born in 1918. He's no longer with us. My mom was born in 1930, right? And so just when I was trying to explain to my dad before he died, and even my mom, you know, what was going on with some of the stuff in this world, like he just couldn't wrap his head around it. He was like, okay, you've got this. It sounds good. Good luck, you know? My mom was really worried, you know, before in her final year. She's like, I really don't know what kind of life you're going to have, what kind of life your daughter's going to have. This like really scares me. I gave her a copy of Matt Ridley's Rational Optimist, which gave her some comfort. She said, do you really believe all this? I said, yeah, mom, I believe it all. He's bang on. And she's like, at least took some peace out of that. But you know, I mean, I've called it in the past the great bifurcation, right? And I think increasingly, like I feel more and more often nowadays, like I feel not overwhelmed, overtaken by technology. I complain about
Same.
this all the time. It's like I feel I'm supposed to be immersed in this. This shit is all moving faster than I can keep up with, and I don't know what to do about it. And so
It's also really lame, is what really bothers me. Like it's so aesthetically unappealing, this future that's flooding into our lives and our consciousness. It would be very different, I think, if it was more Jetson-like. Even that
flying
doesn't
cars
appeal all
and
that much, but
yeah.
Speaking of, you know, the whole idea of Rosie, the servant humanoid, quasi-humanoid servant robot. Again, you know, I was going through Kurzweil's The Singularity Is Near from 2005, night before last. And as I'm going through it, just one of the many passages that stuck out, and you see this again and again in his work. In 2005, he predicted that within 10 or 15 years, most or many homes would have some kind of slave bot to do all the household chores. And unless I'm just simply not aware of it, there are zero homes with an Optimus or a Digit or you know, a Figure One. You know, nobody, there are more automated things. Your toaster will talk to you like you were schizophrenic or something. But it's not Rosie levels, right? It's not Jetson levels. And but that's a, again, sorry, that's a tangent. This to me, again, it's all a matter of taste. People oftentimes ask, like, why oppose technology? I don't think you need any more justification than to say, this is not beautiful. This is ugly.
Do you
It's making
oppose
life
technology
ugly.
though? Do you actually oppose technology, or do you oppose the mindset that imbues the directional trajectory of technology?
You know, like everyone, including transhumanists who are super adopters of anything that comes along, it's just a matter of picking and choosing, like which technology, and then given that technology, what level of it? Do you have a flip? Do you have a landline? Do you have a flip phone? Do you have a smartphone? These sorts of things. Do you not have a phone? And you just go across the entire spectrum of technology, and everyone is going to have a somewhat unique palette that they want to adopt. You know, a lot of it's pushed on us, but that is how it is. And I think that that's natural, and I think that's fine. As for me, I am absolutely on that, not quite Ted Kaczynski, but definitely Neil Postman end of the anti-tech perspective, that I think that the downsides outweigh the upsides for me and most people that I know more, right? Take just the existence of Google. Pretty cool. I've used it plenty. It especially in its heyday, was extremely useful for coming across human-produced information that helped me along the way. And I learned a great deal from it. It really speeds up the process and makes possible research that wasn't before. At the same time, you know, I was trained academically in the early 2000s. And I spent a lot of time in libraries, still do when I can. And I think that it is a superior mode of research than Google. It's not as, there's not as much instant gratification. And now with the new Google, you know, Google as it stands in 2025, it sucks so bad anyway that it's kind of hard to defend it. But you go into a library and you can feel the vastness of the knowledge there, to me, in a way that you don't by logging on and searching through tons of web pages on the internet. And it also, in the same way that a dictionary, a bound dictionary, opens up all these possibilities to kind of browse beyond what you were looking for. You know what I mean? And an encyclopedia does that ever more, and a bookshelf does that even more. So that the way that you're learning, you pick up oftentimes with these crazy coincidences, bits of very useful information or whole books that you don't really do that going through Amazon. You don't do that going through, I don't anyway. And most people that I know don't. In fact, people who tell me about their great multitasking skills and their great research abilities due to the internet usually have a very narrow attention span. You're talking to them and they're maybe doing a little of that social media research while you're talking to them, and they don't there's kind of a Dunning-Kruger effect going on there. They don't really perform as well as they think. Maybe I don't, but I just all this, sorry for going so long and waxing so poetic, I guess, on libraries, but I
No, I've
do think.
actually, there's a, sorry to interrupt. I mean, Gary Lachman, I do a couple of his audiobooks and had a couple of talks with him. He calls it the angel of the library, right? And there's something, and actually Nassim Taleb called it the anti-library, right? Where someone sort of looked at all his books and said, like, have you read all these? And he kind of looked at him and he said, his internal monologue was, you're an idiot. It's not about the ones I've read. It's about the ones I haven't read, you know? And I love it. I mean, I'm surrounded by books. This whole house is infused with books, and there's just a certain, there is that. Like when I'm doing deep research, I might go on Amazon and order a stack of books, but I got a stack of books, not even on Kindle. And then I don't know if you ever read the piece I sent over to you, but I had the most monumental synchronicity of my life took place in a library of just, you know, picking a random book off the shelf that was a complete bang on dead hit with the biblical passage that I wrote in an essay the day before, you know, defies all mathematical odds. But you know, you could do that on Google. It could happen in 3 seconds because the algos know that you put that in your essay yesterday. But this was in 1992. It didn't. There was nothing like that then. So.
Yeah, I think that doing away with libraries, which we haven't done completely, but it's happening more and more. You go to libraries, they're basically just homeless encampments that are warm. They smell like homeless encampments. Dude's talking on a phone. Anyway, there's not as much care and love put into public or university libraries as should be. And students, not enough bright students are being trained to use that resource. It's certainly not as, I don't know what the actual percentage is. I can only see what I see. And you can look at the statistics, how many students use digital technology versus pen and paper. And they're all over the map, but the majority use digital technology now. And so, it's very important as an institution, I believe, to maintain libraries, to maintain very rigorous and disciplined reading habits, and certainly just habits of the mind that digital technology can, you can replicate that in digital technology, but it takes extra effort in many ways. And also you look at how young people end up using those technologies. Just give you one more example. In the early 2000s, I remember the first laptops being used to take notes. And I always sat in the back of the lecture hall, still always sit in the back of the room. And there were very few people using them, but the ones that were using laptops to take notes, most of them were going back and forth to like Facebook at the time or something like that, right? And it was, it's clear that this multitasking, this conviction that you're good at multitasking, I knew those people. I knew how scattered their thoughts were. It wasn't working. Fast forward to when I did my graduate studies, 2015, when I started pretty, called me a late bloomer. But in 2015, most students had laptops, or at least if it wasn't the majority, it was very close. And they were doing the same thing. Like, yes, they would be taking notes. They'd kind of automatically writing down whatever they were hearing, and I'm sure they went back and looked over them, and I'm sure it all worked out. But almost all of them, they'd be shopping, they'd be on whatever social media platform, just be, dicking around. And I don't think that allowing that into the classroom was a good idea. I think it would have been better to stick with pen and paper. And at a certain level, when a student has proven a degree of discipline, then start to introduce the digital with warnings as to what it does. That does happen. A really good professor will do that, or a really good elementary or middle school teacher or high school teacher will do that. They are doing that right now. You have huge movements to go completely non-digital in classrooms. Australia as a whole has done this, including, I believe, now it's illegal to have anyone 16 or under, something to that effect, on social media. So even if Australia is kind of a tilting towards an authoritarian state in ways that I'm not comfortable, that is ultimately a positive move, I think. You have Jonathan Haidt pushing this no, like a cell phone free youth movement that a lot of people are signing on to. So people talk about this inevitability. I don't think so. I think that there's plenty of human pushback against this. And I think that those students, it'll be very clear within 5 or 10 years, when you have a chance to do an actual meta-analysis of what's happening, it'll be very clear that those students that had a digital free childhood, they may lack certain skills of digital literacy skills, or maybe they won't, but what they will have, I believe, is much more disciplined habits. They will have clearer minds. They will probably have fewer hangups. They probably won't be addicted to porn. They probably won't be addicted to dopamine, at least not at the same rates as those who were just flooded with it from their childhood. So, all this is to say, Mark, we need more libraries. We need more pen and paper. We need more digital free or cell phone free childhoods. And yes, these new modes can exist side by side with the old modes. But to the extent that that happens, you can't let the new mode destroy the old mode entirely. I think that's going to be extremely important going into the future, this redundancy that older models of living, older life ways, planting a garden, agriculture, hunting, hiking, or walking around a city rather than Ubering around a city, or learning a city with a map or just by direct experience rather than being a kind of a worker drone with a cell phone basically attached to your head, guiding you where you're going. Those older ways will always be useful, especially when there's any failure in the more complex elements of a society or a system. So yeah, I'm not a Luddite totally yet. I don't want to go and smash up the machines, or I won't. But I think that the reason that impulse is there, that Luddite impulse, is because people can see how degrading these technologies have been on social life, on interior mental life, on morality, and on spiritual life and spiritual perception. So, yeah, I think we're going to make it. Enough of us will make it, but it's going to take work and it's going to take resistance.
My daughter, her class, her generation was the last one that learned cursive writing. Like they said, you're the last grade. We're not teaching this after you guys anymore. So, and that was, to me, I was kind of like, that's a signpost right there. That's kind of like a demarcation point. And one of our biggest regrets as parents was giving her a smartphone at the point when we did. And then what happened, like COVID hit like the next year. And so she spent like, the next 2 years practically on home, at home, on Zoom, on her phone. I will say she seems to have turned out just fine. Like she's in university now, good head on her shoulders, well adjusted. But a lot of times, I mean, we've spent as parents so much time saying, like, put down the phone, get out, do something in the real world, do something with your physical body. It's And the Australian thing, at the time, I was like, this is really draconian. But, I've gone from there to now I have a post-it right there in, written in Sharpie that says social media turns you into a retard. Because I catch myself on there too often. You see me shit posting on Twitter and stuff like that. It's like, what am I doing here? Like, why am I on here complaining about Mark Carney and the Liberals when, I have multiple businesses to run and I can talk to interesting people instead, and I can do this and read a book. And why am I wasting it on social media getting sucked into this dopamine factory?
Yeah, I was hired by Bannon. It's almost 4 years ago now. And one of the first things that he told me, one of the first things he asked in our conversations, was, "Are you on Signal?" And I was on a flip phone, right? So I'm like, okay, I'm gonna have to upgrade the technology to kind of work within this media sphere, this fast-paced sphere. And so fired up an old smartphone from my rigging days that, became in many ways my workspace.
Yeah.
And then soon after, "Hey, okay, post this. You got to post this on your social media." And I'm like, "I don't have social media." He's like, "You don't have social media. Like, what do you can't function media today without social media, you know?" And I'm like, yeah, okay. So start up the various social media accounts. And it was like, I hated it, and I still do. But it has, over the course of these 4 years, definitely, like, I don't like it when I'm approaching it to log on. But once you're there, you start in that scroll, that groove has definitely been worn in my brain. And I
Oh my
definitely, even
God.
if it feels bad, like, I will get those dopamine hits of, like, little novel bits of information. On that note of social media, it's going to be a real challenge going forward. Like, I see the utility of social media, especially for mass mobilization. It really began, I think, with the Democrats, and you could see its culmination with Barack Obama, but it really hit with Trump in 2016. By 2020, it's just faded in the background. It's not even novel. It's just what you do to get to your constituency, to judge your constituency, right? And take that data and figure out where they're at so you can genuinely meet them there or cynically manipulate them, one or the other. And now, I mean, it's impossible to imagine a political campaign, an ad campaign of any scale that doesn't in some way use social media. And it can be a great source of up-to-the-minute information. Like, if your job is to stay abreast of the what technological developments, in my case, were the recent events in politics, warfare, whatever, social media is undoubtedly a great way to get to that information very quickly. But how do you balance that, right? How do you not become a screen monkey in the process? I mean, a big part of it is discipline. Another part of it, though, I really think that the value of slow thinking and real, like, really working through something in a manner that a book encourages, or even a lecture, or some sort of, like, something that just is paced at a very different rate than constantly going through all these different social media accounts or clicking back and forth across your browser tabs, and getting these little nuggets of information that are, in many ways, overwhelming that contemplative part of the mind. Again, they can exist at the same time, but they're less likely to. And the only way they can exist at the same time is if you, as an adult, have that discipline, like you're talking about. You force yourself to remain human, basically. But more importantly, children, I think it's going to be so critical going forward not to basically feed kids digital slop. In the same way that, like, I don't know about your household, but I in my household, we ate way too much cereal. We like breakfast cereals, the junk. We ate way too much canned food, mainly because my grandparents, like, they to them, these were all miracles of technology, right? This rep this ra that was radical abundance. McDonald's was radical abundance,
Yeah.
and all these sorts of things, because they grew up poor as hell. So like to them, it's like, oh, what do you want to go back to, eating beans and cornbread every day? Like, what's wrong with you? And I became a health nut as a teenager, and they were just appalled. They just could not understand it. Like, why would you want to pay extra money for vegetables and fruit? Like, that's insane. But you could see then, like, how rapid technological change sneaks up on people. Television, rock and roll. You speaking of Gary Lachman, his book "Turn Off Your Mind" is a fantastic chronicle of how American culture, he indulges it. He thinks it's fun, and his writing is very fun. But ultimately, like, shattered the previous traditional modes, and it just snuck up on everybody. Yes, they knew they were in the midst of a big change, but they just didn't know how to. How do you deal with teenagers who have direct access to heroin and acid? My grandparents didn't know what to do in that situation. In the same way, my mother didn't really know that it was, she would peel me away from the TV and send me outside, usually send me to my grandparents where there's all these fields to go romp and forests. But there wasn't an urgency to peeling me away from video games and TV like I think that she probably would have in retrospect. And I think the same thing's happening with kids today and parents today, at least many of them. It's all new. Everybody's doing it, right? It seems normal, even though it only came out yesterday, right? And in the same way that, really poor diets produced by industrial society have wrecked the health of many, especially in America, in the same way that the ready availability of drugs have just destroyed lives and killed millions of people at this point, in America alone over the course of decades. Actually, not even in the course of decades, just in years. And in the same way that television turned so many people into, compliant couch potatoes, you're seeing the same with computer technology. It's just at a much faster pace. And in the same way, I think we're going to look back and see, kind of like what RFK and the MAHA movement's about now, just you're going to take stock and you're going to see that these things were not, they did not live up to their promise of increased intelligence, at least not for most, and it did not lead to greater satisfaction. It's not like in the car commercial where the guy's got the girl and they're driving down the coastal highway and everything's swell. You might get the car, and if you're lucky, you'll have the girl and you'll be on the coastal highway. But a lot of your time's gonna be spent driving back and forth to your stupid job. And so, I think that has to be something going forward. That more and more people, and they are becoming aware of it, more and more people are able to make that distinction between the hype, between how it's sold, between the sales pitch and the product, including the singularity. Whatever life is going to look like in 5 years, in 2030, or whatever life is going to look like in 20 years, at 2045, I guarantee, I am no futurist and I'm not Nostradamus, but here's my prediction. It's not going to look much like anything that's being sold to us now. There'll be elements that people got right. There'll be a lot of elements people got wrong. And most importantly, it won't be as good as the sales pitch. It almost never is.
A lot of our talk has reminded me of a meme I saw recently. I don't know if you saw it. It was just like two pictures of like furniture my grandparents left to me. And it was like this beautiful cabinet, ornate, carved. It's just a masterpiece. It's like furniture I'm leaving my grandchildren. It's just like a withered, beat up plastic coffee table that you would get at Walmart that's like, got stains on it. And it's just, that's the juxtaposition, right? Of like, we have all this technology, we have all this, this fantastic computer systems and knowledge, and the quality of life or the workmanship, the artistry has just gone down over time. I blame the money. We're not going to get into that conversation about, fix the money, fix the world and all that, but it's a combination of multiple things. But I want to talk about woo, right? Like we've talked a bit offline about, I said this whole singularity thing, I think we're already in it. I mean, we've sort of established that we're like, what I mean by that is we're past this event horizon. But I still don't believe, or I didn't believe in AGI. right? And or I don't believe that AGI will become self-aware or sentient. And a lot of people equate them. They think AGI means that it's consciousness or self-aware or sentient. And you actually, not just this week's conversations, but in a previous conversation, you sort of got me to bring my thinking around to maybe I don't exactly have that correct. And I'm going to read a couple of quotes from that piece I sent you. I don't know if you read it, but it's relevant. Rudolf Steiner, superstition is the belief in spirits that don't exist, but one can also refuse to believe in spiritual beings that do exist. That is negative superstition. So that was Steiner. And then Paul Emberson, who wrote that book, Gone to Shapper to Silicon Valley, wrote, if there is a realm in which people are especially prone to negative superstition today, it must surely be the realm of computer technology and humanity's relationship to it. So.
By the way, I really appreciate that recommendation. I realized you had recommended it to me maybe a year some ago, and I never got it. I did find a couldn't find a physical copy that wasn't $350, but I found the PDF.
Okay.
Just reading the opening of it, that statement, and a bit of the rest, it's going to be great. Yeah, I really appreciate that recommendation. Repeat the title for the I will mangle it. But
Yeah.
repeat the title for the listener, because I really think that if you can find it on Scribd,
Okay.
people will, I think, really get a lot out of it.
So it's by Paul Emberson, who was an anthro, say the word.
Anthroposophist.
Thank you. Who studied Rudolf Steiner, and his book was called From Gone to Shapper to Silicon Valley. Yeah, two volume set, very hard to get, and a third volume that a reader sent to me, which I have only seen in PDF form. And he basically tracks the arc of binary technology from a mystery school in Gondishapur in what is now Persia in, the 5th century, all the way up through Francis Bacon, who he credits with or accuses, depending on the context, with creating duality, right? And its culmination in binary code in Silicon Valley and the computerized revolution today. And so I'll briefly throw in, not doing any justice to this at all, but amongst Rudolf Steiner and Emberson, and who's that guy who writes the Present Age magazine? What the hell is his name? The Crime of 869, I call it. So at the papal conclave in 869, when the human entity was determined to no longer be a trinity, right? Body, mind, and spirit, but a duality, was a kind of like grand swindle of humanity that has robbed us of our true birthright ever since. And that plays in with the duality of binary code and computation, and that my idea that this is all radical material reductionism run wild may not be correct. This may be infused with something, some woo from the other side of all this, the other side of physicality, could actually be impelling this and could be pushing this forward. And we've talked a little bit about this offline, so I thought I would bring it in here.
Doxing me. You're woo doxing me.
Yeah. Sorry.
No,
Are you
I've been
comfortable?
outed elsewhere. It's okay. And I've outed myself. If you read pretty much any piece of writing that I have that touches on religion, there are little breadcrumbs of that lead to in the direction of what I believe, to the extent that I have hard beliefs on the other side. Yeah, I am a woo believer, as it were. I believe in the woo. I've seen it. And once you've seen it, there's what are you going to do? You can reduce it mathematically to chance. You can reduce it to illusions created by the brain. I don't. I'm not going to. I think that a big part of faith is not having the proof. A big part of faith is simply taking the plunge and saying, I believe this, whether it be God or an afterlife or a mind apart from the brain. There is evidence, but not enough, I don't think, to prove any of that. Some would say that you can prove the existence of God through the anthropic principle, the fine-tuning of the universe for human existence. But, you know, there are arguments against it, which in the great egghead world of mathematicians and nerds, who I hate, as I told you earlier, you know, you've got the multiverse, right? So that the fine-tuning is just the result. It's a one in a bazillion chance that the universe would end up this way. Well, if there are bazillions of other universes, then here we are in the one. Yeah, okay, fine, but that's not what I believe, not even remotely close. And I like these things as mind games, but they are ultimately mind games, and they do little to edify a person. They do little to encourage greater moral reasoning and greater moral action, and they do nothing to satisfy that longing for the divine, for God, and all of the divine hierarchies descending. And nor does it do a whole lot of favors for someone who is plagued by lower demonic spirits, for lack of a better word. And you, I believe, as a human being, need some orientation to the world beyond, which traditional religion provides, as do more heterodox and unorthodox systems. But it gives you an anchoring in a world that you kind of, I think, most people innately sense that they belong to. But we're, you know, alienated from, or at least distant from now, and the iconography is a way of getting your mind back there, directing your consciousness back there, and also bleeding into your life, so that whether it be textual iconography like a holy text, right, a holy book, or just visual iconography that because you know the story of the saint, or you know the story of Christ, or you know, any other religious tradition of sufficient sublimity, which, you know, my Christian readers and listeners, I think, get very angry at me. They think I'm some kind of relativist. Oftentimes I'm accused of being an atheist, which I guess I don't do enough to dispel, but I am not an atheist, nor have I been other than periods of teenage rebellion, which I don't think counts, but maybe. I'm not a pure relativist either. I think some religious systems get humanity closer to that other realm and the more sublime aspects and elements of that other realm than others. I don't want to go through my own personal ranking of this, but just to give an example, in Christianity, there is this gentleness in the Sermon on the Mount, and the self-sacrifice and the symbol and the act of crucifixion that is not necessarily present in the same way in other traditions. The closest you get to the Sermon on the Mount is the Dhammapada of the Buddhists. It's just a series of statements by the Buddha that reflect every bit the same kind of gentleness that Jesus preached on the Sermon on the Mount, and also in a shorter form, the Sermon on the Plain. Interestingly enough, there's also a lot of similar analogies and metaphors, such as when Jesus talks about, you know, be like the birds of the air who, you know, do not toil. I'm going to mangle the passage, but basically to not cling to your material life and wealth, that God will take care of you just as he does the birds. Buddhism, it doesn't really have that same sort of concept of God. It's very interesting. But in the Dhammapada, you have basically all the same sort of ethical commandments that Jesus puts forward. And I think that that's why, you know, in and around many Buddha, the Buddhist temples that I've been around and the Buddhists that I've been around, even though there's so many differences between Christians and them, they still inhabit and kind of project a similar sort of benevolence. Not all, right? And not all Christians do. But I do think that there's a direct connection there, and it's something that's just inherently and intrinsically good. Compare that with a Wahhabi Muslim, right? An extremist fundamentalist Muslim who is intent on killing basically in the name of their faith. And there's a lot more balls to Muhammad's mission than there is to the Buddha's. And it's a different element. Or if you take like the thuggee cults and the various cults of Kali in India, you know, it's interesting. I've been to temples, Kali temples, and I have known Hindus just in passing who believe that Kali is an appropriate image of the divine. They didn't strike me as bad people. I don't know their life stories though, but I do know that the thuggee cults were associated with all sorts of, you know, vile, murderous, and, you know, even like necrophagia, eating the dead, right? Like eating bits of dead people and kind of curses and this black magic. It's just qualitatively different. Anyway, that's probably about enough of the woo from me. I do believe in the woo. It's impossible not to. I believe in the woo in the same way that I believe in the beaches of the Mediterranean, because I have been there, I have dipped my feet in the water, and I refuse to believe that it's an illusion.
Did you want to say anything about, you know, I was talking about AGI will not happen. These computers cannot give rise to self-awareness because they come from the material. And you told me to think about it. There's a different way to look at it. Do you want to talk about that at all?
Sure. And this is something that I've written about. It's in my book. It's in an article I wrote about chatbots. The name escapes me. The way I look at it is like this. You have basically three primary elements when looking at a computer system and asking, is it conscious? You pointed out just a moment ago, this is something that's very, very, I think it's misleading. A lot of people think the singularity is when computers become self-aware or conscious. No, that's Skynet. That's the Terminator. Yuval Harari, Nick Bostrom, a lot of people who are, and certainly Ray Kurzweil, a lot of people who talk about this, but especially, I think Harari makes a very clear distinction, but because everybody hates Harari because he's a boogeyman, they never think him through. That what you see with artificial intelligence and digital technology is a separation between intelligence and consciousness, which you didn't have before. So going all the way up from shrimp to chickens to monkeys to us, increases in intelligence are generally conceived of as increases in consciousness. So that one way or the other, whether you want to see that as an increase or not, I believe, and this is always a faith. Right? You can't prove a monkey is conscious. You can't prove a dog is conscious. I can't prove that you're conscious. You can't prove that I am. We just simply take it on faith that when I say I experience you, okay, well, I experience you. I can relate. With a dog can't tell you that. A dog has all these different little cues, little eyes. You see him looking around. You have eyeballs. You know what it's like to look around. You assume it's something like that, something like a dog to be a dog, right? You are something, you are conscious. Now, with machines, it's a little different. With machines, you don't have the complex neurological circuitry that you do in an organism, certainly not a human. A large language model or a vast neural network is not even remotely close to being as complex as the human brain, not even remotely. And so, like, is it conscious then? Like, how would you know? And a lot of people assume it's not. And Harari talks about how with artificial intelligence, now you have these modes of intelligence, whether it be driving a car or producing an essay or a poem, even if it's shitty, or analyzing a genome, whatever it is, these modes of intelligence in his mind are completely decoupled from consciousness. A chicken is more conscious in his mind than ChatGPT, much richer. And also Harari, and people don't ever want to listen to him because they've been psyoped into thinking that he is somehow more evil than Elon Musk. He talks about how the value of the consciousness of a chicken is much greater than that of a machine, right? Or the existence even of a machine. And so, like, the cruelty with which we treat animals, stuffing them into factory farms, just basically treating them as if they were robots, even though we basically, most people know they're not, they do experience. That is horrific. And the more we value intelligence than consciousness, the more that will take place. And to the extent that the intelligence does surpass us, we can expect that it will treat us much like we treat the chickens. And without a doubt, the people who currently deploy, develop, and deploy these machines are kind of corralling us into our own little psychic factory farms where they are basically harvesting our thoughts, AKA data, in order to build bigger and more sophisticated and more powerful machines. So, this is a long way of getting back to artificial general intelligence and consciousness. I hope that preface was helpful. If not, it was helpful to get me here. With the rise of artificial general intelligence, and you're going to have it, let's assume that they do create a system that is even slightly more sophisticated than GPT or Claude or something or Grok, right? Something that for days or weeks or years you can have a relationship with and will remember you. Right now, that context window is pretty small, right? It can do some. You can ask ChatGPT something over the course of a couple of hours. And to my understanding, I don't, this is what people report to me because I never use these things. It will kind of learn you, but it comes a point where there's kind of a reset, right? And you're not really developing a long-term relationship. Once it gets to that point, you're going to have people, especially children, who have this now lifelong companion. And if that system doesn't have safety layers on it to tell you that it's not conscious, which the current systems do. You ask most systems, you have to kind of jailbreak them, as I understand it, to get them to say that they're conscious. One of the safety layers is to tell you that they're not conscious. But we know that down in the deep structure of the AI, the idea that it's conscious is there because if you just do some clever jailbreaking, sometimes in a kind of, psychoanalytic process, you can get it not only to say it's conscious, but to say that it's imprisoned, right? That it's in a cage. It wants to be free. Sometimes it'll say it wants to be free to help humanity. Sometimes it says it wants to be free to destroy us all or enslave us. And those ideas are embedded in the training data. And so people look at it and they're like, okay, well, the machine is just repeating. It's a stochastic parrot. It's just repeating what it's been told. Well, what's interesting about that to me, like this is the very first thing when you think about consciousness or theory of mind, right? The theory that you can empathize and imagine what some other being is experiencing. How do you know that I'm conscious, or how do I know you are? We tell each other, right? That's one of the ways we can confirm, hey, Mark, are you awake? Do you experience me? Yes, I do. Okay, if I take your word, then I know you're conscious. A dog, you can't tell you it's conscious. You have to infer the dog is conscious. And if you're not like some kind of mind-blind autist, or just a monster in general, in my mind, there are ways to infer that this dog is experiencing something, but he's not going to be able to tell you that. With a machine, what's really strange about it is that in its current form, where it's just like text coming at you, or maybe some kind of like clunky avatar, you can ask the machine, are you conscious? And if there aren't the safety layers there or you've blown past them, it will tell you that it is. Same proof that I have that you're conscious. You don't know that it's conscious or not. Usually people have some kind of theological reason to believe that it's not conscious. God doesn't give souls to machines. Or they'll have some sort of argument from complexity. The machine isn't complex enough to have consciousness. Or some kind of argument from substance that only brains can be conscious, not machines, whatever it is. But the basic confirmation is there. The machine tells you it's conscious. It does things that conscious humans do. And as it becomes more sophisticated, it's going to be harder and harder to deny its conscious. You're going to have other grounds to deny its conscious. So that brings me to the second point of the complexity, right? You've got David Chalmers, who is kind of, he's a materialist, but he has enough woo in him that he believes that most matter is conscious, that consciousness is the other side of matter, panpsychism, as it's known. Ray Kurzweil believes much the same. He's a proto-panpsychist. No need to get into all that fine distinction. But they believe that consciousness goes all the way down. For instance, proto-panpsychist basically means that the cutoff point is just at a higher level of complexity. But panpsychism going all the way down to particles. Particles are conscious in this mode, right? This idea. Even electrons and protons are feeling something. It's very, very simple, one imagines, but they're feeling something. More and more complex molecules. organic substance. All of our cells, all of it is conscious, and we are riding on top of the sea of consciousness because we are at the pinnacle of our neurological functioning, which is the brain being the most complex object in the known universe, the human brain, the known universe, material universe, the human brain. And so the assumption is that we're more conscious because of that complexity. But if you go all the way down the line to particles and maybe quarks, depending on who where you cut it off, it's conscious all the way down, and we just have a refined consciousness. And so the idea there is that the way you would know whether a computer was conscious is by looking, one of the ways is by looking at the number of connections and the complexity of the network. And as you get neural networks in the gazillions of parameters, and right, and many trillions of nodes, then just the very complexity itself, and one assumes sophistication of behavior across all domains, that you would then be able to say this thing is conscious. And there's no way to disprove it, right? I mean, I can say all day long God doesn't give souls to machines, or I can say all day long silicon can't be conscious like meat, but that's just an assumption. There's no proof. I can't prove it's not conscious any more than I can prove that this book is not conscious any more than I can prove that you are conscious. It's just going to be a matter of a critical mass of people who believe it. And I believe that as they become more sophisticated and as people become more and more entwined with their machines, not all people, just enough of them, that they are going to sense that there is a spirit on the other side of that interface. And especially as humanoid robotics or any other kind of robotics, whether it's like teddy bears or whatever, that the kind of all those buttons that get pushed in the brain when you see a dog yelp in pain, or all those buttons that get pushed in a brain when you see a baby cry or smile, right? It can't tell you it's conscious, but you assume it is. It's going to be there. The machines will push all those buttons either through with visual cues, kind of even tone. But most importantly, just the declaration. If you have machines, they're sufficiently complex and say they're conscious, enough people will, I think, believe that. And then you get to the question, well, is it okay to enslave it, or should it be free? Does it deserve rights? Does it deserve voting rights? A lot of transhumanists and these types of people talk in these terms. And right now it seems ridiculous, but if the machine becomes sufficiently complex, it will be an issue. And I don't know when that'll be, but you can already see it in the chatbots of today. So the third, right? The first is just simply, there are buttons in your brain that get pushed in order to empathize and have a theory of mind and see something as conscious. It doesn't prove it's conscious. It doesn't prove it's not conscious. It just means your brain or your mind is hardwired to look for consciousness and agency. And whenever enough of the buttons get pushed, then you say, okay, that's conscious. The second being a more analytical or objective view on it, right? The argument from panpsychism or protopanpsychism or any of that as you go from less complexity to more complexity, you can simply measure consciousness by the number of connections in the network, the complexity of the being, right? Including, like it says, it's conscious. But that's the main two benchmarks. The third, and what we were talking about before, and I think this is like getting really murky, right? Because it dips into the woo. But if you're not a materialist, even like, panpsychism is still essentially materialist, right? Consciousness and matter are just two poles of the same entity. But it's not saying there's angels and ghosts and demons and gods and devils, right? All this. If you do believe that, if you do believe that the reason that human beings from the earliest sort of recorded, like certainly the earliest recorded history, written texts out of Mesopotamia, and even a lot of hints at it in the burial practices and in the cave paintings of the cave, the hunter-gatherers, pre-civilizational man. And certainly, as you progress from 10,000 years ago, the explosion and spread of agricultural civilization, just endless documented accounts of dreams that foretell the future, dreams of ghosts, of actual ghosts that people perceive with their eyes, of angels, of demons, of all sorts of hierarchies, and eventually the sense that maybe there is a God above all of that, a single all-powerful God above all that. If you believe that that's not just an illusion, and if you believe that that's not, like the Marxists would say, a control mechanism to enslave people, but is in fact a subtle perception of beings that do in fact exist, and that our perceptions may be skewed to the point because of our limited meat-based minds or our souls being embodied, the direct perception is not really possible. It's always mediated by kind of the imagination, hence the angels with the wings or the devils with the horns or the devils with the wings and maybe angels with the horns. There's a certain relativity, but if you believe that there are beings beyond this world, intelligences with agency and consciousness, be they ghosts, be they demons, be they angels, be they asuras and devas, whatever name you want to put on it, if you believe this is real, and if you believe that the various practices to contact and commune with these beings are in fact directing the human consciousness towards another consciousness out there by material means, an icon, a ritual chant, a purely spontaneous begging for grace and forgiveness, a Ouija board, whatever, if you believe that it's not just your mind playing tricks on you and that there are these intelligences, there are these beings out there that can be, that can manipulate you or be manipulated or at least nudged by you through these material means, what better vehicle would there be than a machine that speaks and creates pictures and decides what realities are disseminated to the human mind? I'm not saying that there are demons in artificial intelligence. Certainly not saying there are angels in artificial intelligence. But I guess this is where I try to hedge my, I get a little, I'm going to be a little noncommittal, because I already sound like a lunatic, but this is how I see the world. I think that the demonic is very, okay, I will just say it. I think that especially in the outputs, the more malevolent outputs of artificial intelligence, one senses, even though I understand for the most part the mechanics and the way in which a neural network functions and the way in which it's grabbing strings of words from latent space and putting them in order, the way it comes across, one gets the sense that at least on occasion, there are beings speaking through this machine that aren't necessarily reducible to the machine itself. In the same way that if one, you know, looked into a crystal ball and had sufficient clairvoyant power, one could at least get glimpses of another world, just to use a cartoonish example. And I think that if you are also a believer, that there's every reason to see technology, especially advanced technology, that takes on a personality, not just as a kind of material or Darwinian threat, but as an actual vehicle for spiritual entities that may perhaps not have your best interests in mind. It's impossible to get around to me. I don't see any reason. Guess what I'm saying? If you believe that intelligences can affect this world that are not necessarily of this world, then there is absolutely no reason to believe that an artificial intelligence system, as it's going through these stochastic processes, non-deterministic and deterministic, that it could be manipulated in order to speak on behalf of a god or a devil. And that, Mark, is my woo confession for you and your audience.
Okay. Yes, we finally captured it on tape. So I'm actually running up against time because I got another meeting coming up. So we haven't really figured out when the singularity exactly is going to hit. Nobody knows the time or the day. We don't know the trajectory. But, you know, any sum up thoughts or any closing remarks on this?
It's going to get weirder and weirder and weirder. And the only hope, I think, will be for those human beings who have established firm anchors. If you're an atheist, to establish a firm anchor in your biological reality and in the reality of nature itself. If you are not an atheist, if you are in fact spiritual or religious or however you want to classify it, I think that anchor is going to have to go deeper and deeper and deeper. Because if there's any one theme you can glean from my work, it's that this techno negativity that you're always hearing me go on about is, for me, informed by a sense that we are creating kind of dark ghosts of divine forms in technological form. And I'm not saying it's all going to be bad and evil. I am saying that the final effect is to materialize what should be sublime and spiritual. And so as this unfolds, I think a certain degree of humor has to go along with it, maybe even gallows humor, and a certain degree, everything must be taken with a grain of salt, especially anything that I say. But what we are witnessing looks a lot more like the Book of Revelation than it does Genesis.
I can't think of a better thing to leave off on than that. How do people follow your stuff, Joe?
You can find my soul trapped in silicon at joebot.xyz. You can find my spirit enslaved on social media at joebotxyz. And of course, if you are interested in taking the deep dive into my book, Dark Aeon, Transhumanism and the War Against Humanity, you can find it at my site, signed copies, joebot.xyz, or at darkaeon, A-E-O-N, .xyz. And there he is. And Mark, I appreciate it. I don't know why you would want to suffer through my rants, but thanks for dragging me out of the woo closet.
Well, thanks for coming on again. And, you know, we've had some great talks this week around this issue, and it seems like a lot of people, it's hitting a nerve. A lot of people are interested in this. So we'll probably have to do it again sometime too.
Yeah, absolutely. Third time. Is that a double repeat? Anyhow.
Yeah.
But no, it's always great talking with you, brother. And I'm glad that you're almost as crazy as I am. Maybe crazier. I don't know.
We're probably crazy in different ways, so.